From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Well, we're in Holy Week, everyone. Tomorrow is Easter Sunday, the big celebration in our Catholic Church and in our Christian Church around the world. Millions of faithful will be celebrating this very special day. And today we'll be focusing still on the Passion of Christ as we head into Easter Sunday tomorrow. I'm excited today to replay an interview with you with Dr. Timothy Malaya. We talked to him. He's a board-certified orthopedic surgeon who presents on the medical view of Christ's passion. So this is a doctor giving from his perspective all that Christ endured in his suffering and death. And we'll also be talking with Mary Jane Zuzulo about Unveiling the Sixth Station. It's a brand new book about the Holy Face devotion. Of course, we talk about St. Veronica at that sixth station, the wiping of the face of Christ. And what is the meaning of that for us, even in our modern world? We'll be looking forward to talking to Mary Jane later in the program. And check out my episode on EWTN of They Might Be Saints, which airs every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. We have one about Rhoda Wise coming out on April 10th. In Canton, Ohio, Rhoda Wise was well known as a mystic with many spiritual gifts and healing miracles, one of them experienced by Rita Rizzo, the future Mother Angelica. And I'll be relating the remarkable story of Rhoda Wise. And again, that's on Wednesday, April 10th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And check out a new episode of my program, Explore with the Miracle Hunter. I always love when the new episodes get to air, and so we've got another one. And for an Irish guy like myself, I was excited to travel to Ireland and to film at Kildare, where we explored the life of Ireland's most famous female saint, St. Bridget of Kildare, who was renowned as a miracle worker. So check that one out. That's on Saturday, April 6th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Explore with the Miracle Hunter, brand new episode as we go to Kildare. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about Our Lady of the Rock in the 365 Days with Mary segment, and it's in Alessandro da Rocca in Italy in the year 1620. The might-be saint of the day is Blessed Restituta Kafka from Austria. She's a martyr. And the question of the week is, did NASA really examine the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe? So we'll try to get you that answer in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we talk about the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And of course, we have the Shroud of Turin, which is considered perhaps to be in a chiropoito or not made from human hands image. It is the purported burial cloth of Christ residing in Turin, Italy. It's a possession of the Pope. And there's been testing over the years and maybe even centuries in different ways to figure out if this is truly the burial cloth of Christ. And in 1988, those famous tests came back with carbon-14 testing that said that it was most likely a medieval forgery. But since then, things have sort of turned around in shroud science, and there is actually a new study that came out that says the linen of the shroud is Middle Eastern. And new isotope tests prove it, and that is coming to us by a professor Professor William Meacham, and he did a study on the shroud and its linen fibers. And so recent testing on several threads from the Shroud of Turin provided a strong indication that the flax used to make the linen was grown in the Middle East, specifically the Western Levant in Israel, Lebanon, western part of Jordan, and Syria. And now it's probable that it has a Near Eastern origin, Middle Eastern origin. New doubts must be raised about interpreting the shroud as simply a fake relic made in the medieval times of Europe. And new questions arise as to what the image on the cloth means. And this possibility that the cloth is actually the burial cloth of Jesus is strengthened by this new evidence. In the view of Professor William Meacham, he says that remains the best explanation of the shroud, even though the carbon-14 issue is yet to be resolved. And he said, the isotope results of this linen are not proof of its origin. However, there's a slight overlap of a couple of samples from Western Europe with those of Israel. Similar slight overlap occurred also in the baseline testing done in 1988. Various scenarios can account for the anomalous results, and most can be eliminated with further research. And the previous testing project was conducted with the goal of eventually determining the place of origin of the Turin Shroud using hydrogen and oxygen isotope ratios. And so this was a new article that came out from Professor William Meacham. I'm going to post the link to the Facebook page to get people to take a look at this new research that relates to the Shroud of Turin. And again, makes it, there's no proof positive test yet that this is the real burial cloth of Christ, but everything points in that direction. And of course, if the cloth were just a medieval forgery coming out of France or Italy, you wouldn't see any of the linen coming from the Middle East. So it's quite an interesting development in shroud science. So we'll be posting that article to the Facebook page of The Miracle Hunter. Now let's take a look at Catholic Pub Trivia. We do this every week where we ask a trivia question and give it a prize to an emailer that writes in with the right answer. And winners will receive the image of the faces of Mary. And last week we talked about the Holy Face devotion, and we said it goes back perhaps to the legend of St. Veronica. And so the question was, what is she known as the patron saint of? She may have various patronages like many saints do, but she is primarily known as the patron saint of photography because of the image that appeared on that cloth, that face cloth of Christ, or that wiping cloth that she used. And that was answered by Mark Propkop from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thanks, Mark, for writing in with the correct answer. We'll be sending you out the prize, the image of the faces of Mary. The question for this week, we'll be talking today about the medical view of Christ's Passion with Dr. Timothy Malaya. And the question is, what was the name used to describe the burial cloth of Christ before it was known as the Shroud of Turin? Again, the question, what was the name used to describe the burial cloth of Christ before it was known as the Shroud of Turin? If you think you know that answer and want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe you'll be the fastest one with the prize, and answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Mary Jane Zuzulo, the author of Unveiling the Sick Station. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to The Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. We talk about some of these great miracles in Christian history and great relics, and perhaps one of the greatest relics of all time, although we don't hear much about it these days, is the Veronica Veil, or the Manipolo image, or perhaps the Edessa image, the Holy Face of Jesus in its various forms in various relics all around the world. Well, there's a brand new book that's out. It's called Unveiling the Sixth Station of the Cross, and it's brought to us by Mary Jane Zuzulo, who's the author, and this comes to us from Sophia Institute Press. And this is an exciting book because this is an old devotion, but there are so many miracles that are associated with these incredible relics, and the story is amazing. So we're so excited today to welcome to the program Mary Jane Zuzulo.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Mary Jane, thank you so much for your book. And I think that this is an exciting book, a devotion that's been around for a very long time, but even so, one that most Catholics really aren't too well connected with. So I'm so excited for your book, Unveiling the Sixth Station of the Cross, to shed some light on the Holy Face devotion. And I think that from what I understand is that you have sort of a generational connection to this. You are the great-great-great niece of Sister Marie de Saint-Pierre. Tell us a little bit about who she was and how she's connected to this devotion.
Oh, sure. Well, we of course knew growing up about Sister Marie de Saint-Pierre, but for me that was in the 70s and early 80s, and there was a real de-emphasis on devotions, and my mother was sort of discouraged from investigating further into the devotion. And at the time, we weren't aware of many writings on the devotion. Once my grandfather passed away, we found some of the books and materials that had been passed down from my great-great-grandfather, who was the eldest brother of Sister Saint-Pierre. That's how her Carmelite sisters referred to her, and that's how we spoke of her in our household. But we even had one of the original biographies translated from the Carmelites in New Orleans that was inscribed to my grandfather. And that was really the only English book that we had. The rest was in or were in French. And so we tracked down another copy of this, and this was before the time of the internet. So it took some time, but we found this, and we're just amazed. And there is a kind of a shortened version, the Golden Arrow, but the original version is what I use in all my research because it gives the full context of her revelations and her spiritual life, which are sort of a set of revelations in themselves. So, you know, I was excited to bring this more to light to the reader. And of course, if they have more interest, they can, that original biography is now more available. But yes, I think in terms of how I came to write the book, I was struck by what a lot of people just in the last couple of years seem to be realizing, and that is the extreme relevance of the devotion. And a main reason of this is that communism is as addressed in the devotion, and we are to use the devotion as spiritual armament in its defeat. And of course, now communism is manifesting so blatantly in our faces, you know, whether it's societal norms or education or government or our religion. You know, I can talk more about this, but I guess just to kind of jump ahead, you know, there was at the same time the frustration of why so few seem to know about it now when it was an enormously popular devotion for the first 70 years or so, probably in large part because of the miracles at the hands of Venerable DuPont. But then finally, you know, as I really researched more into it, I was just struck by its profound spirituality that I don't think has been spoken about a lot. I think maybe it was somewhat understood at the time of that original biography, but it's a beautiful spirituality really in line with that of St. Therese of Lisieux and the whole Carmelite mystical tradition for that matter. And it really ties in with St. Louis de Montfort's true devotion to Mary as well. A lot of people don't realize it's a very Marian devotion. And so, yeah, I guess just wanting to help understand that we may be now recognizing the effect of neglecting the devotion and you know, at the same time that kind of highlights the necessity of it as remedy. And, you know, the devotion is to bring about the conversion of the multitudes. And so it assists our, it complements Fatima and it assists Our Lady in her celestial battle with evil. And yet at the same time, it's a valuable aid in man's own salvation as well as even outlined in the promises of the devotion.
Wonderful. We're talking today with Mary Jane Zuzulow about a new book called Unveiling the Sixth Station, available from Sophia Institute Press. And we're talking today about the Holy Face devotion. And for those listeners who might not even know what this devotion is, let's take it all the way back to the beginning. What are the origins of the Holy Face devotion?
It was given to Sister St. Pierre after the time of the first French Revolution and just kind of right in the midst of the second. The beginning stages of the second, you know, during that time period, there was free thinking, there was Freemasonry, there was the beginnings of communism and modernism, you know, kind of springing off of rationalism of the Enlightenment. And so all these ideologies are overtly blasphemous. They're not just ungodly from men, you know, falling into sin from weakness, for example. But they are anti-God by design, and so they really affront the rights of God as outlined in the first three commandments. And Christ came to Sister St. Pierre and desired that she initiate this devotion to make reparation for these extreme offenses. And, you know, to paraphrase Christ, it is shockingly referred to him as the highest devotion. So it's the greatest devotion to make reparation for the greatest sins, which are modern affronts to his rights, to God's rights. So, you know, the blasphemies that are aimed against the divinity fall back, so to speak, on the face of Christ, renewing his injuries. And so, much like Veronica, who sought to console Christ's injuries on the way to Christ's way to Calvary, Christ calls for Veronica's to console his renewed injuries now by means of reparation. And we are to use, however, not our own merits and love, but the merits and love which are sort of encased in the wounded Holy Face. We're to make the offering of Christ's wounded Holy Face to the Father in reparation. So we're relying on the power of God that is residing in his face. And so it's sort of an offering of God to God, which does mirror the consecration at Mass, in which Christ presents himself as a perfect offering to the Father. And there are, you know, ways in which this devotion is not only an extension or a means of co-redemption in Christ, you know, everything goes through Christ, but also, you know, an extension of the Eucharist in some sense. That Christ's face is veiled in the Eucharist, after all, and in the devotion, even the Sacred Heart of the Most Holy Sacrament of the altar is called upon to make this reparation.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the connection to St. Thérèse. St. Thérèse had a great devotion to the Holy Face herself. Where do we trace her devotion, and how is her spirituality intertwined with this?
Okay, I think at first glance, people may not see the connection because, you know, St. Thérèse was a great advocate for mercy, and she really did not want to get involved with personal merits to appease justice, so to speak. And this devotion is all about appeasing God's justice, however, for the purpose of drawing mercy. But I think it there's really different layers in which they are super complementary. But I think that ultimately, the devotion itself, as I mentioned, it doesn't involve personal merits either. We're relying on the power of God, the love and merits of Christ in this devotion. And that was what St. Thérèse was all about. And she was known for saying that the wounded Holy Face of Christ was the foundation of all her piety. And I think that you can take that in different ways, but one way is literally that she relied on the merits of and love of Christ to be her piety. She said at different times that she wanted to use the sanctity of God to you know, grow in love for him. And so, you know, they're both kind of saying the same thing. And in fact, St. Thérèse did have an enormous devotion to the Holy Face. She was introduced to it through the Holy Face devotion. She and her sisters and her father were among the first ones to enroll in the Archconfraternity of the Holy Face, which was, by the way, approved immediately for the whole world by Pope Pius the 13th. And so he really broke from tradition in doing this. And I think he seemed to have a real sense of the times and what was needed as remedy for the time. And, you know, in fact, Pius the 9th had said of the devotion that it was destined to save society. And so, yes, whether you are looking at St. Thérèse's little way, that really reflects back to Sister St. Pierre and the devotion and her love for the child Jesus and that whole idea in Carmel of spiritual poverty. But, you know, then St. Thérèse became sort of champion of co-redemption, offering not just her countless little sacrifices, but even her, the suffering, I can't believe I just forgot, but the John of the Cross is, talks about the dark night of the soul. There we go. And, you know, she offered that as well. And, you know, for her, the consolation of God and mercy of man was just kind of one emotion. And that's what we're after in the devotion as well.
Wonderful. We're talking today with Mary Jane Zuzulo about her brand new book, Unveiling the Sixth Station. We're talking today about the Holy Face Devotion. This is a new book available from Sophia Institute Press. And of course, we love talking about miracles on this show. And I know there are many, many miracles associated with the Holy Face Devotion. And one of the big ones is this miracle of the Vatican. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Sure. So about 6 months after Sister St. Pierre passed away, it was in January of 1849, that, as I mentioned, this was kind of in the midst of that second French Revolution, and that had rocked all of Europe, including the Vatican, and the Pope, Pius IX at the time, had to flee to Gaeta for safety, and so he was asking that the faithful venerate the Veil of Veronica. So there was an exhibition. You know, he wanted to make reparation and plead for mercy. And during this veneration, public veneration, there was for a 3-hour period, transformation of the veil. Most people know it's so old and its features have become very blurred and difficult to make out. And plus, there's kind of a thin veil over the actual veil, but the image became miraculously enlivened, so to speak, and very distinct. And so the canons of the Vatican, you know, rang the bells, and people came in, and the notary was there to copy information about the miracle, and then people were asked to draw what they saw, and they came up with, you know, very similar images. They're slightly different because different people were drawing them, but engravings were made and copies were imprinted, and then these imprinted images were touched to the actual Veronica veil, the Lance of Longinus, and the true relic of the cross, and they were given out, I think, mainly at first to convents, but venerable Leo DuPont did receive one. He was very close to the Carmel in Tours, where Sister St. Pierre was located. And he venerated the image by having an oil lamp burning at all times in front of it and the Holy Scriptures. And just the first miracle kind of happened by chance. A woman complained when she was visiting of an eye ailment. And he said, well, let us say some prayers that are consistent with the devotion. The Archconfraternity hadn't been approved at that time, so they weren't formal prayers of the devotion, but, you know, then anointed her eye, and she was healed. And then, you know, this happened again with a priest not long after, and then 6,000 documented miracles, and many more besides, maybe as many as 10,000 in person, and then he sent these vials of oil throughout the world. People would just write Holy Man of Tours, France, and it would, you know, the request would get him and he would send them out. So it's really hard to know exactly how many were performed, but we know how many were documented. And Pius IX referred to him as perhaps the greatest miracle worker in church history. And, you know, that's just astounding because none of us really know this. I was shocked myself when I first heard it.
Yeah, absolutely amazing, incredible miracle stories here on the Miracle Hunter Radio Show. We appreciate all that. And we've been talking today with Mary Jane Zuzulo, the author of a brand new book, Unveiling the Sixth Station. For people who want to find out more about this book, which is available at Sophia Institute Press, or more about you, Mary Jane, where can people go?
SophiaInstitutePress.com, where you would be able to order the book. I also have a link for that on my website, which is holyfacedevotion.org.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Mary Jane Zuzulo, for joining us to talk to us about this incredible devotion, the Holy Face Devotion, and about your brand new book, Unveiling the Sixth Station. Thank you so much for joining us on today's program.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
God bless. That was Mary Jane Zuzulo. Check out her book, Unveiling the Sixth Station. Everything you want to know about the Holy Face Devotion. It's an older devotion, but it is definitely catching fire these days. Lots of people are interested and fascinated by this incredible devotion and its many miracles. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question, did NASA really examine the image of...
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And I love getting the email questions, of course, and I try to answer those on each show. But I also like getting questions when I give a talk, and I travel around the country, maybe giving as many as 20 talks a year at different Catholic shrines and parishes and conferences. And so if you'd like to have me speak at your conference or shrine or a church, you can go to my website and click on the contact tab, that's miraclehunter.com, and send me a message, and perhaps I'll be speaking in your area sometime soon. And I've been speaking a lot about Eucharistic miracles, because that is, we are in the time of Eucharistic revival in our American Catholic Church. So definitely contact me that way. But one question I got through email this week, which is a good one, says, Dear Miracle Hunter, I have a question about whether NASA examined the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City. Is there a reliable source where we can find out if NASA really did and where the results of the examination of the image of Our Lady? Sincerely, Maureen. Well, thank you, Maureen. It's a great question. And one of the interesting things about Our Lady of Guadalupe, and she will always stand as my favorite Marian title and favorite Marian apparition site. And I've been there numerous times to Mexico City to see the Tilma, and I hope to be back again. It's truly my favorite devotion. And there are so many miracles related to Our Lady of Guadalupe. You can check out my program called Guadalupe Mysteries on EWTN. Go to EWTNRC to see that, rc.com, to see Guadalupe Mysteries. And I go through all the various things where we talk about how there was a bomb that exploded right next to the Tilma and it didn't damage the Tilma, or the miracle of the eyes, or the miracle of the nitric acid spill, or any of the other things that have been in the long-lasting nature of that image, and not knowing how the image was made, put on the cloth. These are all aspects of the Tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe that we might say are miraculous. And there's a lot of, we wouldn't call it hagiography in this case, but there's a lot of rumor and speculation and stories. For example, one story is that the image on the Our Lady of Guadalupe image floats above the cloth. Well, actually, if you see a photo of the backside of the cloth, the ink or the coloring, as we might say, bleeds through to the backside. So it doesn't, of course, float above the cloth. So there's various things like there's a heartbeat that can be found on the, if you put a stethoscope up to the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, or there have been signs of light emanating from her. There are various things that are claimed, of course, and they're not all true. And one of the claims that has been made is that NASA scientists flew into Mexico City and conducted a battery of tests on the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe and declared that it was not made from human hands and science cannot explain it. Unfortunately, while some of the testing that has been done on the shroud, maybe, or on the Tilma, excuse me, perhaps corresponds to tests that NASA would use, or perhaps the instrumentation that was used in some of the testing, the photographic equipment perhaps was on par with NASA's equipment, or the same even, there has been no, there's no truth to the story that NASA, in fact, conducted the tests. So there is no reliable document because the test didn't really happen. This is one of the stories or legends that that often springs out of a true miracle story, but NASA wasn't on the examining team of scientists who did that. So thanks so much, Maureen, for your question. And if you have a question for the Miracle Hunter, you can send me an email to questions@miraclehunter.com, and maybe I'll be answering your question in the air next week. Let's take a look at the 365 Days with Mary project. We do this every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the days. It lines up exactly to the day's date. We all know Fatima on May 13th, or Lourdes on February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th. But believe it or not, there's a different Marian devotion for each and every day of the calendar year. It lines up to a feast day, a miracle that occurred there, or another celebration, or the building of a basilica or a church on the site. There's a different way to honor Mary on each and every day all around the world. And so for today's day, we've got Our Lady of the Rock from Alessandria della Rocca in Italy in the year 1620. And the story goes that in 1620, Alessandria, a blind young woman, had her sight restored during an apparition of the Madonna, and Mary requested that a church be constructed for the veneration of a statue that would be found hidden in the rocks of a hill. Convinced by the miracle of Alessandria's sight, the townspeople excavated in the spot, she was told, and found a beautiful white Parisian marble statue. A church was built to house the statue, and the first hermits of St. Anthony Abbot promoted its cult. A new sanctuary was built in 1820 by the hermits, who brought the image back on March 30, 1873, and at the close of the Marian Eucharistic Congress in 1939, the sacred image was officially crowned, and that is Our Lady of the Rock, Alessandria della Rocca, in Italy in the year 1620. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com, or you can go to the Facebook page 365 Days with Mary and join any of the 10,000 other followers, or you can download the free app from 365 Days with Mary Marian Calendar from the Apple App Store. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we look at people on the path to sainthood as it lines up to my television series, They Might Be Saints, which airs on EWTN every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And we look at from miracle workers to martyrs to those ordinary people living extraordinary lives of heroic virtue. These are the people that make us wonder if someday they might be saints. And so we're looking at venerables and blesseds, servants of God, those people who don't have all their miracles yet as recognized by Rome. And so we always try to keep you up to date on who's coming down the pipeline when it comes to future saints. And on March 14th, the Holy Father, Pope Francis, received an audience, His Most Reverend Eminence, Cardinal Marcello Semeraro, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Cause of Saints. And during this audience with the Holy Father, he authorized the same dicastery to promulgate the decree regarding the heroic virtues of the servant of God, Liberio Rodriguez Moreira, a diocesan priest born in 1884 in Lagoa in Brazil and died also in Brazil on December 21st, 1980. And according to the website for the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, he was a diocesan priest who was simple, humble, and poor, and he lived his life spending himself solely for the Lord and for others, dedicating himself in a particular way to the sick and the poor whom he helped materially and spiritually. And the Christian communities that had him as pastor considered him as an authentic man of God, and the superiors, aware of his excellent pastoral skills, attributed to him the care of multiple parish communities at the same time. And so that is now venerable Liberio Rodriguez Moreira, and with one miracle he'll be blessed, with a second miracle he will be declared a saint. And if we look at the Might Be Saint of the Day, we do this every week to see which future saint lines up to that day's date, whether it's a feast day or a death anniversary. For today we've got Blessed Mary Restituta Kafka, who was born on May 1st, 1894, in Czechoslovakia, modern-day Czech Republic, as Helena Kafka. And she was the sixth daughter of a shoemaker. She grew up in Vienna, and she worked as a sales clerk, a nurse, and she joined the Franciscan Sisters of Christian Charity in 1914, taking the name Restituta after an early church martyr. And she worked for 20 years as a surgical nurse, beginning in 1919. And she was known as a protector of the poor and oppressed. And she was a vocal opponent of the Nazis after the German takeover of Austria. And Sister Restituta hung a crucifix in every room of her new hospital wing. The Nazis ordered those crucifixes removed, but she refused. And she was arrested by the Gestapo in 1942 and sentenced to death in October of 1942 for aiding and abetting the enemy in the betrayal of the fatherland and for plotting high treason. That was what she was accused of. Martin Bormann decided that her execution would provide effective intimidation for other opponents of the Nazis, and she spent her remaining time in prison caring for the prisoners. Even the communist prisoners spoke well of her, and she was even offered her freedom if she would abandon her religious community. She declined, and she is now a martyr. She was beheaded on March 30, 1943 at Vienna. She was declared venerable in 1988 by Pope John Paul II in a decree of martyrdom. And on June 21st, 1998, Pope John Paul declared her blessed and officially a martyr. And so that is Blessed Mary Restituta Kafka from Austria. And with one more miracle, Blessed Mary will move on to become Saint Mary Restituta Kafka. And that's the Might Be Saint of the Day. And for people who want to check out my television series that looks at Americans on the path to sainthood called They Might Be Saints, on Wednesday, April 10th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, the episode on Rhoda Wise airs. In Canton, Ohio, Rhoda Wise was well known as a mystic with many spiritual gifts and healing miracles. One of them was experienced by EWTN foundress Rita Rizzo, the future Mother Angelica. And I'll be relating the remarkable story of Rhoda Wise. So check that one out coming up on April 10th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Timothy Malaya. He is a certified orthopedic surgeon going to be telling us about the medical view of Christ's passion and death. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. Well, it's Holy Week, as all Catholics know, and we've passed Good Friday. And of course, during Good Friday, we always reflect on what Christ suffered for us in our sins. And we all have this sort of conception of perhaps watching the movie, the Passion of the Christ, or other such films. And we have this mental picture of what it might have been like for Christ to suffer for us. But beyond having a mental picture, perhaps we have an actual picture. And this is the purported burial cloth of Christ. It's the Shroud of Turin. And from that shroud, people have studied this over the years, including scientists and doctors who have been able to look at the flow of blood. They've been able to identify injuries that Christ would have suffered in his incredible sacrifice for us. And we're excited today to talk with somebody who's an absolute expert on the Shroud of Turin and sort of the medical aspects of what Christ suffered in his passion, and that's Dr. Timothy Malaya. He's a board-certified orthopedic surgeon from Ohio, and he travels around and he gives presentations to local parishes or shrines or conferences talking about, from a doctor's perspective, what Christ suffered for us. Welcome back to the program today, Dr. Timothy.
Hello, Michael. It's always good to talk with you. Thank you.
It's great to have you back on, and I know this is a big week for you. You're a sought-after speaker talking about Christ's passion, what he suffered from a medical perspective. Tell us first, how did you first get drawn to the Shroud and get drawn to trying to understand the medical details of all this?
You know, as a cradle Catholic, it's hard to ignore it. But when it really captured my attention, my imagination, I was in my last year of medical school, and this was 1986, an article in the American Medical Association's journal was published, and the title was simply The Death of Jesus Christ. And it was really an eye-opening experience for me, because I think, like many people, many Christians, You read about it, and it's so difficult to imagine what it was like that we tend to gloss over it. But when you look at it from a medical standpoint, it is astounding that Christ survived as long as he did, given the magnitude of the assault that was, I mean, not just physical, but emotional and spiritual, and that he survived as long as he did. So that was fourth year medical school. I've had medicine pounded into my brain for all those years, and it just opened my eyes to this really did happen, and this was a horrible, horrible episode.
Absolutely, and we have the Gospels to go on. We have the Shroud of Turin to reflect on. The Church has never officially approved it as the authentic burial cloth of Christ, but I, for one, believe that it is very likely to be that. I don't know what else it could be. So when we talk about your reflections on the Shroud, your reflections on the Gospel, what have you learned? And it seems that, well, Christ is superhuman, but it seems like it took superhuman strength to endure what he did.
Absolutely. That to me is the most profound proof that Jesus had the two natures that we're aware of. He had a divine nature, had a human nature. Well, when you think about the last 18 hours before the crucifixion, before he died on the cross, that 18 hours is a display of his human nature. We cannot ignore that he was fully human as well. Now, we'll never be able to personalize it to our own experience, but it's almost impossible to imagine what he would have gone through in that period of time. But to me, on both a physical level and a theological level, that's what makes it so difficult to even begin to comprehend. He put up with all of that. He knew what he had to do. He had to go through with it. And it was all not for his benefit. It was for our benefit. And to me, that equation of love equaling sacrifice, it is the epitome. There is absolutely nothing that can supersede that in regards to an example of sacrifice for love, laying down your life for one's friend.
That's right. It's absolutely amazing. We're talking with Dr. Timothy Malaya, orthopedic surgeon, talking to us about the medical view of Christ's passion. So let's get into some of the details here. What did Christ suffer leading up to his crucifixion? Of course, there's a very gory scene in the Passion of the Christ, which is very difficult to watch. Year after year, I will watch that, and you know, tears come to my eyes because I just can't watch it. What did Christ endure with the scourging and the crown of thorns? What did Christ get into leading to his crucifixion?
I mean, certainly those are the most gruesome and just repulsive parts of the whole passion sequence. And even prior to that, you know, emotionally, he's been abandoned by his friends. He has been assaulted intermittently, if not continuously. There's no indication that after the Last Supper he had anything to eat or drink. In fact, when he was offered wine before he was nailed to the cross, he refused to drink it. And so you throw into all of that dehydration and exhaustion and all the others. And then the scourging comes along. And, you know, it pains me to say this, but I think that in Gibson's movie, I think that's about the most accurate representation of it, a recreation of it that we would see. I'm increasingly suspicious that the primary cause of death was blood loss. Hmm. And blood loss in a healthy man, in his 30s, would have to coming from a scourging that was as thorough as you see in the movie. That's a significant amount of blood loss. And then the crown of thorns, I strongly suspect that what we see in artwork is not representative of what the crown of thorns looked like. I do not believe that the Roman soldiers would have taken the time to weave together a neat little wreath. Mm-hmm. I think they just took a bramble of these thorns, a vine with a half inch to 1 inch thorns on it, and they just plopped it on his head like a helmet. And may have secured it with a piece of rope or something like that, because on the shroud, and again, I tend to agree with you. I really think it is. I don't think that God wants us to know it for sure, but our faith can fill in that gap. But on the shroud, blood stains on the head are not, you know, they show areas that are not where a wreath of thorns would be. It's where a helmet-shaped crown would be. And anybody that's had a small cut on their scalp knows they bleed like crazy. The blood supply to the scalp is very rich. There's another reason for the blood loss hypothesis as the leading cause of his death.
Absolutely. We're talking today with Dr. Timothy Malaya, talking to us about the medical view of Christ's passion. And, of course, after the scourging, after the imposition of the crown of thorns, we see Jesus walking a great distance. That's according to Catholic belief and tradition, and even the way people have mapped out that distance from the Roman Praetorium to the top of Golgotha. That is a long, long way to go to be dragging, even if it's just the patibulum, the crossbeam of the cross. That's a long way for anybody to even walk after they've gone through that. Talk about the exhaustion and the impossibility, perhaps, of Jesus dragging a cross all the way to the top of the hill.
You have the word that is operative in all of that is what you just said, impossibility. I mean, and even if you're carrying just the patibulum, the crossbeam, that's given the wood that would have likely been used, that would have been 25, maybe 30 pounds. But the arms are tied to it. Imagine carrying a backpack, but it's propped on the back of your neck and not on your back. You have to stoop forward with that. And you have gone through 18 hours, nothing to eat, nothing to drink. You're being beat up almost continuously. You've been scourged. You have had the crown placed on your head. You have bled probably more than 30 to 40% of blood volume, and more than 40% blood loss is immediately life-threatening. And so he truly, this to me is the miraculous part of that episode of the Passion leading up to the crucifixion, the fact that he made it. And, you know, and one of my favorite supporting characters in this whole episode is Simon of Cyrene. Now, this is a man who, it's 1,100 miles from Cyrene to Jerusalem, and clearly he was coming, certainly for the Passover. He goes 1,100 miles, and what does he walk into the middle of? Then he's recruited. He helps Jesus with the cross, estimated maybe the last half of the distance. And talk about a conversion. We know he shows up in the Acts of the Apostles, as do his sons. So even in the midst of that chaos and that gore, there's conversions taking place. We know that from the centurion and the others that actually saw when the Roman soldiers said, "Surely this was the Son of God." There were conversions immediately, in addition to the good thief, to Dismas, the good thief on the cross.
Absolutely, yeah. It's unspeakable. It's unknowable how Christ was able to do that. And then we get to the crucifixion, the top of the hill, where Christ perhaps is already affixed by rope to the patibulum, and then he's hoisted up on the other beam, and then he's left there to die. Talk about the experience, perhaps, of the weight of one's body collapsing down on your lungs with a spear wound in the side or whatever else would have been complicating things. What did Christ experience on the cross itself?
Well, an unimaginable pain. I mean, the ability to remain conscious with that much pain is striking. The nails in one of the greatest debates has been, were the nails through the palm of the hands or through the wrist? I've even flip-flopped on that. But with nails there, nails in the feet, and then the ability to breathe, you know, typically when you breathe in, a normal person taking a breath in, that requires muscle power. And when you breathe out, all those muscles relax. On the cross, it probably would have been the opposite, what's come to be known as paradoxical respiration. So for him to inhale, he would relax, lower his body down, arms would go above shoulder level. And if you watch someone who's trying to catch their breath after running a race, they'll often put their hands over their heads. That increases the size of the chest. But then to exhale, he would have to pull up on his hands, on the nails in his hand, and push up on the nails in his feet. And that would only increase the pain that goes along with it. And at the same time, with the blood loss that he's experienced, if you're anemic, which happens when your blood count is low, you do not have the endurance. You do not have the stamina to be able to withstand that type of stress.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And then when we hear of Christ breathing his last breath, giving up his spirit, what, in your medical opinion, did Christ die of in the end?
I think, you know, the term that we always use in medicine that helps us dodge that question is multifactorial, which mm-hmm. means it's a multiple choice question. However, I'm as convinced as I can be it was a sequence of two primary factors. One, the significant blood loss I mentioned. Someone that was, if you take the man on the shroud, that's a man who's about 5'10" and 175 pounds. And that's a big man for that time. Average height then was probably about 5'6". And if he loses more than about 6/10 of a gallon of blood, that exceeds that 40% threshold. And he would be in danger of death very quickly. So you have a man whose blood count is low, who's very anemic, and what happens when the heart doesn't get enough oxygen, and that happens with a very severe blood loss, it develops an arrhythmia. And the heart rhythm is abnormal, and there are many, many, and you talk to any cardiologist, a patient that is in a bed being observed that develops an arrhythmia like that, all of a sudden, they will often look at the doctor and say, I'm going to die, and then they pass out. And to me, lose the blood, get the cardiac arrhythmia, and when Christ says, into your hands I commend my spirit, that was his way of a patient telling the cardiologist, I'm going to die. He knew. I mean, there was just that sequence of events that he was fully aware. He was fully aware spiritually of what he had to do, but he was equally aware physically of when it was happening. I think the case made for suffocation or asphyxiation, I don't put much credence in that, because, you know, we all are aware of his seven last words, or really they're phrases, but they're right. Classically known as seven last words. Someone who is suffocating is not going to be able to speak clearly, articulately, where people can hear him and where his words can be recorded. So I really think till his last breath, he was aware. It was low blood loss. He was running on, in medical terms, he was running on fumes, and his heart just did not get the oxygen. And he felt that change in the heart rhythm, and that's when he lowered his head and died.
Well, thank you, Dr. Timothy Malaya, for going through the details one by one of what Christ may have suffered. And we know this through the Gospels. We know this through the Shroud of Turin, the medical information that can be garnered from that. When you reflect on all this, all your years of study, all your early interest in this and your early days of being a doctor and all the way till now when you travel around the country and give these presentations, what does it do for your faith knowing what Christ suffered for us?
It's really a bulwark of my faith, because it's so easy for those of us that work in medicine to look at something like this, like a coroner's case, like a medical examiner's case, and trying to be objective about it. And that's our job when we put on the white coat. But if we're going to look into our heart, into our mind, into our soul, and study this, even if you're looking at it from a medical standpoint, you cannot escape the amount of devotion and commitment and really the love that permeates this horrible episode. I mean, really, this whole episode is the hinge of history. What would life be like now if that had not happened? It completely changed the trajectory of civilization. So if you look at it only from a medical level, yes, it's interesting, it's fascinating, but that is just a trivial amount of the meaning of this, of the passion and the crucifixion. If it doesn't impact anyone thoroughly and completely, then they're not studying it close enough.
Absolutely. Well, we're so grateful to you, Dr. Timothy Malaya, joining us today amidst your busy schedule during this Holy Week. And we thank you for your ministry, traveling around and sharing the details of Christ's passion with us so that we can truly know what Christ suffered out of love for us. Thank you so much for joining us on today's program.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a blessing. God bless you this Easter weekend.
Yep. Have a blessed Easter. And that was Dr. Timothy Malaya, board-certified orthopedic surgeon, giving us the incredible detail of Christ's passion and death. And that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to ewtn.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Dr. Timothy Malaya, talking to us about the medical view of Christ's passion, and Mary Jane Zuzulo for her new book, Unveiling the Sixth Station, from Sophia Institute Press. Check out a new episode of Explore with the Miracle Hunter on Saturday, April 6th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Kildare. I'll be exploring the life of Ireland's most famous female saint, St. Bridget of Kildare, who was renowned as a miracle worker. And I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Happy Easter, everyone.